Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Riesmandel, and I'm your host. Today, we're talking about translators. Not the guys who go from German to English, but the ones that make radio stations go further. Because sometimes they go a lot further. They're free, but some folks are making money on them. John Anderson from DIYmedia.net and Free Press's Media Minutes is with me to tell us more about the research he's been doing on this often neglected but very important part of FM broadcasting. And maybe we have a few moments. We'll find out what's going on in the pirate radio scene, too. You will want to stay tuned. Hello, John. Thanks for joining me again.
Hey, Paul. Thanks for having me.
I guess we're looking to be... The Media Geek will be the longest page on your CV, right? Underneath all media appearances.
Have you seen it?
I have not seen it yet.
Under my radio and print interviews. Yeah, you're about 90% of them. Thanks a lot for that. I kind of missed not being here in July.
That's right. It's been nearly once a month, I guess, this year.
Yeah.
But you've also... Part of that reason is because you've just been jamming on the research this year.
Yeah, I've been trying.
The things you've been uncovering are things that more people need to know about, I think. And so one thing that we've been talking about for a couple of years now, right, has been the translators, has been the stations which rebroadcast the signals of other stations, and then when they're non-commercial, they can broadcast a station that's thousands of miles away.
Yeah, they can actually feed them via satellite and set them up as standalone operations. Normally, translators were supposed to be based as a secondary service where if a full power station wanted to extend its range or if it wanted to try to get around a terrain obstacle in the area and maybe cover a dead zone, they would apply for a secondary radio station. These stations are FM only, 250 watts maximum power. And that was the initial idea of what translator stations were going to be. They were going to supplement full power stations. But then back in like the 80s or 90s, there was a change in the FCC rules which allowed non-commercial users of translators to feed them remotely via satellite.
And was that pushed for by NPR? Was it pushed for by the Christian broadcasters? Did they sort of gang up?
I think it was partially both. I think it was NPR and Christian broadcasters, but mostly religious evangelistic broadcasters. Public radio stations do use translators, but they typically set them up to cover specific areas like a state or maybe two states, whereas religious broadcasters' use of translators, they're building regional and national networks with these things. So it's a little bit more...
And they're much less expensive than full-power stations, and they actually can be crammed in a little tighter on the dial.
Yeah, they can.
Than can both a full-power or a licensed low-power FM station can be.
Yes, they
the
can.
The ultimate irony
yes,
of it all.
It's the ultimate irony that LPFM stations are only 100 watts but are more restricted on where they can be placed on the dial than translator stations, which are 2.5 times as powerful but can actually fit closer than full-power stations than LPFMs can. And that is because of legislation passed in 2000 by the NAB, at the behest of the NAB and NPR, Congress eviscerating the LPFM plan as they did. But translators... they are a pox on the FM dial, as I like to say.
And when we last spoke about this issue, we were talking about a couple of groups of religious broadcasters, which I put in quotes almost as broadcasters, who had scooped up quite a number of licenses for translator stations in the last licensing window the FCC had. Was that back in 2004? 2003.
13,000 applications for FM translators filed. More than one-third of them went to two entities named Radio Assist Ministry and Edgewater Broadcasting, who are one and the same. They are a guy by the name of Clark Parrish, who lives in Twin Falls, Idaho, and was instrumental in setting up another national religious translator broadcast network for our friends Calvary Chapel.
There's Calvary Chapel stations all over the country. There is one in the Champaign-Urbana area now, here in Illinois, and across Illinois. They're in just about every state.
Yeah, they are.
And so what's the most recent news here about, I mean, because the news isn't just that they got one-third of the licenses.
Right.
It's what they did with them.
Yeah, well, over the past 3 years, Radio Assist Ministry and Edgewater Broadcasting have been parlaying these construction permits into money. They apply for free through the FCC. Clark Parrish actually wrote a special program to essentially auto-spam the FCC's electronic application filing system.
Because this is done on the Internet now.
This is done on the Internet. All the applications are filed electronically. And that's how he was able to snag more than 4,000 FM translator licenses. And what he's been doing has been shopping these licenses or these construction permits to build translator stations around to interested entrepreneurial religious broadcasters. And over the course of the last 3 years, as far as I can tell, Radio Assist Ministry and Edgewater have sold upwards of $2 million worth of these translator station construction permits. And the latest thing that they've been doing was with their largest client, actually. When Radio Assist and Edgewater needed to get this off the ground, they needed a couple of sugar daddies. They needed some established religious broadcasters who'd be willing to front them the money so they could start to sell these things and start to actually accumulate some capital and keep the whole scheme rolling. They hooked up with a Calvary Chapel church in Florida and helped that church build essentially a statewide network of translator stations based on an FM station that the church already owns, basically saturating Florida with like 4 dozen radio signals for this biblical evangelistic Calvary Chapel church. But now the other person or the other entity that helped Radio Assist and Edgewater start and make all these sales is a place called Horizon Christian Fellowship, which is actually based somewhere in California and has loose ties to the Calvary Chapel franchise.
Right, because Calvary Chapel isn't sort of a centrally organized church the same way as we think of a lot of Protestant denominations. It's almost franchised. You go, as a pastor, you go and become basically ordained,
as if,
for lack of a better word.
As if the early people that got into the McDonald's business had to go to Ray Kroc and get permission to set up a McDonald's in their town. Anyone who wants to set up a Calvary Chapel has to travel to Costa Mesa, California and talk to a guy named Chuck Smith. And if he blesses them, then they're out and they can plant churches.
And their church goes with them.
It's all based around the single pastor who plants it. They're a very shepherd-centric kind of organization. Anyway, Horizon Christian Fellowship, the founder of that franchise, this guy by the name of Mike McIntosh, actually was good buddy-buddy close friends with the Calvary Chapel group and decided to kind of split off and do his own evangelistic, biblical-centered teaching thing. And now he is in the process, Mike McIntosh and Horizon Christian Fellowship are in the process of building a nationwide network of translator stations. And they've done this just in the last 2 years. They have bought from Radio Assist Ministry and Edgewater Broadcasting through a series of small transactions involving, a dozen of these at a time. They're not buying all of them at once, but over the course of several transactions since 2003-2004, Horizon Christian Fellowship has assembled a radio network of more than 140 radio stations in 21 states.
That's like Infinity Broadcasting.
That's like Infinity Broadcasting, but, you know, from scratch. This wasn't just a consolidation of one company buying another. These are brand new radio stations being set up on the cheap, on the fly, using loopholes in the FCC regulations that operate to the detriment of other users.
So compare that to low-power FM stations.
Well, low-power FM stations, there's only been one round of filing windows for those way back in 2000, so it's been 6 years, and there hasn't been any new opportunities to apply for new LPFM stations. It had to go through all this rigmarole, and you couldn't sight them as close on the dial as you could to full-power stations.
So there's more translator opportunities.
There's lots more translator opportunities out there than there are for siting LPFM stations. However, there is a move afoot at the FCC and also in Congress by media reform activist folk to attempt to basically re-expand the low-power FM radio service out to the FCC's original parameters. And the original parameters, in effect, they would have been a little bit more restrictive than how translators can be cited, but it would have opened up more spectrum for LPFM stations. Well, even if this rule actually does get passed and the service is re-expanded out to the FCC's original intended parameters, a lot of opportunities for spots on the dial for new LPFM community stations are gone because of this flood of translator
stations. And these translators are, by their very definition, most of the time now, not local.
Right.
So whereas low-power FM was designed as being a particularly local community service. So even if it's owned by a church, it has to serve the local community with 8 hours
of programming a day.
Programming a day that is locally originated. These translator stations are specifically forbidden.
Prohibited by law.
It.
They can do, I think, up to 60 seconds, 30 to 60 seconds an hour of local donation soliciting. So they can say, hey, Champaign-Urbana, if you like hearing this biblical talk, please send money to this address. And that's it. That's the most local programming they can do.
So they are designed, basically, instead of low-power FM, all these slots are being taken up by franchise, satellite-driven, evangelical Christian broadcasters.
It's almost worse than if you think of a Clear Channel, a regional programming scheme or something like that, where if there's one person sitting in an office in San Antonio programming stations in New Mexico, Arizona, Utah, Colorado, Wyoming, you know, Nebraska, all these stations, right? But if there's still one person sending out playlists every week or every month telling the stations what to play, here, it's just one station, one uplink somewhere in California feeding hundreds of stations where there aren't even people to play one single thing all the time. So it's even, in my view, it's more abusive of the public airwaves than something like even a Clear Channel consolidation voice tracking scheme.
And in this scheme, the guys behind, you know, RAM and Edgewater, Clark Parrish, walks away with $2 million for stations he never even had to build.
Right. Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, what he's doing is, and what other, these, and I need to clarify here. Clark Parrish is the baddest of the bad guys as far as translator mongering goes, you know, sucking up all of this spectrum and then selling it off. But what he's effectively engaged in is speculation. He's acquiring the rights, if you look at it this way, like real estate speculation. Somebody acquires the rights to property that's not developed, then they turn around and flip it to a developer and make a profit off that, and the developer's actually in charge of building the radio station. Clark Parrish could build translator stations. He's done it before. I'm sure he's actually helping some of his clients do that, and I know that he has his own, one of the things he wants to do with this money is set up his own religious broadcast empire. But essentially what he's doing is he's swapping pieces of paper, which he got for free, through an electronic filing system for cash. And, that doesn't strike me as being the most, Christian thing. But, that's just me and my own personal opinion.
And you are listening to Media Geek, your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Reisman. I am your host, and with me in the studio today is John Anderson. He is the man behind the website DIYmedia.net. He's also the producer of Free Press's Media Minute, which is a weekly five-minute news wrap-up at the intersection of media and democracy, where there's a lot of accidents and occasional jaywalkers.
I sweep up the broken glass at the intersection of media and democracy. That's what I do.
And you can check that out at freepress.net/media minutes, and you can check out the Media Geek website at mediageek.net. And we're talking about translator stations, which are there to rebroadcast a signal of other stations, eating up lots of spectrum and being turned into effective, low-power non-commercial radio networks all over the country. But it looks like the National Association of Broadcasters is interested in getting a little bit of that translator action too.
Yeah. This was a very interesting piece of documentation that came my way late last month. Essentially, it's got a little bit of a backstory to it. Right now, the radio industry is pushing for the digitalization of radio. They're rolling out something called HD radio, and it's effectively digital audio broadcasting. You're going to need new radios to listen to it, and they promise that the sound quality is going to be better and that they can actually broadcast multiple channels on one single frequency and all this other wonderful stuff. But it also has a lot of problems in that the signals that digital radio stations broadcast are actually fattened. They're a lot wider than your traditional analog station. Therefore, they have more potential to interfere with neighbors on the dial. And the place where this interference is most prevalent and most egregious is on the AM band, where, in fact, the FCC has not allowed AM stations to broadcast in digital because at night they cause so much hash across the continental United States that it's hard to listen to anything.
And people who've listened to AM at night know that signals go much further and that powerful stations can cover most of the continental U.S.
Right, and when they're broadcasting a signal that's effectively three times as wide as they once were, that's going to cause a lot of problems. So in July, the FCC was supposed to issue another rulemaking as part of this ongoing transition of radio from analog to digital. Well, it was pulled off of the agenda at the last minute. This was like July 13th, I think it was. On July 14th, the National Association of Broadcasters files a petition with the FCC asking that AM radio stations be granted a certain number of FM translator stations to supplement their own coverage. The rationale that the NAB was giving was that the AM band is suffering the most from interference. They say mostly from natural sources like hair dryers and traffic lights and things like that. But in a footnote, they also mention digital radio and say that the interference problem is going to get a whole heck of a lot worse because of the coming of digital radio. So if, in effect, what the NAB is asking is that the FCC allow AM stations to get FM translators to supplement their coverage area because their original AM signal is going to be crucified by interference from digital radio. So we have a problem with the technology, and we're going to fix it by putting more signals on an already crowded part of the radio dial.
It's like a, and it's like a whole nother station, whole nother license for free.
Not only that, but the money in digital broadcasting, and especially the multicasting function where you can put multiple streams on a single frequency, is only possible on the FM dial. And the AM broadcasters of America, commercial AM broadcasters especially, have been complaining that the developers of digital radio have neglected the AM side of the equation. They know that FM's where all the money's at, that's where you can do all the fun stuff. And the AM broadcasters have been saying, but you're leaving us behind and you're going to make our signals even more degraded. So the NAB's like, hey, let's give the AM broadcasters a piece of the FM pie. And that just ain't right.
No, and when you think about that, most of the largest AM stations are usually co-owned with FM stations.
Right.
So it's very unusual that a single AM station is owned by itself in a market. If you look at almost any major AM station, even in a market as small as Champaign or Urbana, it has a sister FM station, which usually plays music. But that's a programming choice.
Right.
Kind of reminds me to go back to the early days of the FM dial, you know, back into the 50s when most people didn't have FM radios. Most AM broadcasters pick themselves up an FM license, but just simulcast their AM signal until the FCC started forcing them to put original programming on the FM side.
Yeah, and to give you some sort of example of the extent to how many new FM channels could be occupied by commercial AM broadcasters under this scheme, let's think back to what we were just talking about with religious broadcasters and their use of translators. In 2003, during what I call the Great Translator Invasion, 13,306 new applications for translators were filed during that. You know, a third of them went to radio assistant, all that, but that's a lot. 13,306 applications is almost doubling the number of radio stations that exist in the United States currently. All right, there are 4,759 AM radio stations on the air nationwide. Now, the NAB's petition asks that effectively AM radio stations get enough FM translators to guarantee them 25 miles of solid coverage. That's right.
Wow.
Right. Now, that's going to take more than one FM translator station per AM
station.
Especially
at 100 to 250 watts a piece.
Right.
Right.
So let's say, just on for an average, three FM translator stations are required for each AM radio station. Guess what? That's as many stations as were tried to be grabbed in the Great Translator Invasion. It's translator invasion all over again.
And it would probably squeeze out the possibility for any more low-power FM community stations.
Yeah, LPFM is looking to get screwed hardcore.
So the NAB, it's interesting that they're going for this strategy because, one, it would squeeze out low-power FM. Two, they'd be taking up stations, squeeze onto the dial in a way which they say, when done with regular low-power FM stations, causes too much interference to the 10,000, 20,000, and 100,000 megawatt stations. So clearly, it's not an issue of the stations causing interference, but the stations, who owns them, who controls them, who programs them.
Yeah, it's a blatant grab for more spectrum for the coming of digital broadcasting, and that's it's a sad thing. I don't know if the FCC's actually accepted the petition for filing yet. I haven't seen the FCC formally say, yes, we're going to consider this or put on any sort of notice of proposed rulemaking, but it is something worth watching, especially since possibly as early as next month, the FCC could actually advance the digital radio transition by a couple more degrees. And if that includes using AM at digital radio at night, then we're going to expect static hash on a crazy scale.
Yeah, except for your most local stations with the highest power to you.
Right.
It's just going to be nearly unlistenable. Good luck trying to pull in those distant stations.
Yeah. No, sorry, DXers, you're in trouble now.
So let's turn to a different topic, one that is something that you sort of begin following as an avocation, and that's pirate radio.
Yeah.
And there's a couple guys not too far away from us here in central Illinois, up there in the Quad Cities area on the Iowa side of the river, in Bettendorf, who just got some fines.
Yeah, $27,000 worth of fines for this one radio station, Power 103.3 in Bettendorf, Iowa, the part of the Quad Cities. Now, these guys apparently were broadcasting a commercial radio station, so they set themselves up to be commercial, and their format was the greatest hits of the 80s and 90s, which, of course, we already don't have enough of on the radio dial.
But they were going to do it better.
But they were going to do it better because they thought they could do it better. And they found out about this little provision in the Code of Federal Regulations involving radio broadcasting, which basically says that in a time of war or national emergency, people can file informal applications with the FCC to put radio stations on the air if they do so with the idea of furthering the war effort or helping their community survive the war effort, yada, yada, yada. And there have been some pirate stations around the country who have glommed onto this and went, ah, look, it's a free pass. It's a way I don't have to apply for a license because, look, there's the war on terror and the war on drugs. And
so they were the war, I guess they're defending the war on the 80s and the 90s.
Right. And so, it's the war on new shoes and, and Shaka Khan. I don't really know what they were doing, but the problem is they didn't read the statute. And the statute says you have to apply to the FCC informally. You got to send them a letter with your name, your address, the type of broadcast equipment you plan on using, the power you're going to run it at, the frequency you're going to do, and this is a quote, a statement of facts which, in the opinion of the applicant, constitute an emergency to be found by the FCC for the purpose of this section. The statement must also include the estimated duration of the emergency, and if, during an emergency or war declared by the President or Congress, why such action without a formal application is necessary for the national defense or security or in furtherance of the war effort. Now, there has been at least one pirate radio station, Free Radio San Diego, 96.9, San Diego, California, that actually followed the rules. They sent a letter in to the FCC. They said, hi, we're going to go on the air. Here is our informal application, and this is why. And that's fine. Free Radio 96.9 in San Diego has been visited by the FCC. They were raided a couple years back and everything like that. But they keep bouncing back, and the FCC has not really gone after them too hardcore in the most recent past. These guys in Bettendorf throw up the Nushu Shaka Khan station.
And completely above ground, yeah, just acting like any commercial radio station.
They invited the Quad Cities Times into their office so they could tape them, or they could take pictures of them, cheesing over the microphones. They made up yard signs that said, like, support free radio and all this other great freedom of speech stuff. But they didn't actually, follow through. And now the FCC, because they showed up to inspect them, and one guy met him with a video camera at the door, and the other guy stood there with his arms there and said, no, we're broadcasting under the War Powers Act, and you don't have a warrant, so we're not letting you in. Well, the FCC is now going to make an example of these guys, and that's why they fined them both. One of them, the $17,000 fine went to the guy who stood there and said, no, you can't inspect. And the $10,000 fine went to the guy holding the video camera, both of whom have been quoted in local media and have been very above board about what they're doing, but they didn't quite think everything all the way through, and if they try to actually challenge this in court, they're probably going to lose. So,
and how many of these, War Powers Act stations have there been?
I know of, I think, four.
And since what? Since 1934?
Yes. Actually, I don't know how old this statute is. I should actually probably go back and look that up. The first confirmed usage of this Code of Federal Regulations provision that I know of was back in 2002 in Seattle, Washington, when micro radio activists converged on the place.
But was that one where the FCC approved it or took notice of it?
No. All that they did there was they had applications ready with
so
blanks.
So it was
to
used as a sort of proactive defense.
It was just basically a stymie maneuver,
right,
where if the FCC showed up, they'd
give them...
In terms
of, we don't know if there have ever been any stations which the FCC has sort of acknowledged exist that have used this as an opportunity to be so-called licensed.
No. However, back in 2003, the FCC did reduce a fine against some baggage agency or security agency at JFK International Airport in New York City, because This company came in and they took over for another company and they bought all their equipment, and with that came two-way radio systems, which required FCC licenses. And this was before September 11th, right? So 2001. And so they bought everything like 2 weeks before they came in. They set up business in JFK using all this other company's equipment that they bought. The licenses expire on the two-way radio systems. Terrorists hit New York, and they don't apply for them. So the FCC finds out that they're basically running pirate two-way radio things on an airport. And the company's like, oh, well, you know, in the war on terror and everything, we got so busy that we just forgot. And the FCC bought it, partially at least. They said, because you were fighting the war on terror, you didn't have time to worry about such ministerial details as filing an application for a license. They still were fined, but it was reduced. So I guess the short answer is no, the FCC's never made some sort of, you know, sort of waiver situation or given a free pass to anybody who's done this on the air. But they are willing to consider extenuating circumstances. But again, in the case of these Bettendorf folks, I don't think that's going to happen.
So there's sort of a assumption or a principle flowing underneath this, I think, at least that we probably share the opinion that if you're going to go and try and do an above ground pirate radio station, you probably better be there for your community. You probably better be there for the larger good, for more democratic means, rather than just putting up some commercial radio station, you know, and that, you know, part of the fight of the free radio movement and that turned into the micropower movement and helped push low power FM was democratic access to the airwaves, not more top hits on the airwaves. Not more profit-making radio.
Not only that, but like if you really want to challenge the licensing system, like in a truly fundamental way, and possibly even engage the FCC in court, you need to dot your I's and cross your T's.
You know, and Stephen Dunifer attempted that with Free Radio Berkeley, and even so, his case was shot down on a formality.
He didn't apply for a waiver. He didn't actually ask the FCC, can I do this even though you don't make accommodations for it? If he would have done that, if other pirate stations that have tried to challenge the FCC in court would have done that, they would have actually had standing to challenge the rules in court. But they get caught in these administrative jurisdictional wiggle things,
because that's the way the law works,
right? But and it's tough. I mean, if you're a pirate, you're going to break the law. Why would you telegraph your intent before you do it? So I mean, it's kind of a catch 22.
I guess if you're going to do it and you want to break the law, then you just sort of, there's people who break the law every day in a thousand different ways, from speeding to smoking pot to doing a lot of things, and you sort of accept that you're doing that and you absorb the risk and the consequences that come with it. And there might, and it may be for broadcasting without a license, that the value of the broadcast, the value of what you bring, the value of what you get out of it, makes it worth the risk.
Yeah.
And I guess, you know, you say, well, then you absorb that risk, but the more above ground you do it, it's one thing to say you're going to smoke pot in your basement. It's another thing to say you're going to walk down, you know, during the 4th of July parade with a big bong, you know, smoking away.
Right.
Two different kind of approaches to the same situation. One is more risky than the other.
Yes.
And, of course, people can check out your website, DIYmedia.net. A lot of this information is there. I got some stuff about the Quad Cities guys at my website at MediaGeek.net, including a link to them mugging for the camera in the
great
Quad Cities Times. looking like cheesy FM, commercial local FM radio hosts. And, of course, Media Minutes gets posted to the web every Friday. You can listen to five-minute broadcasts there and at stations across the country, freepress.net/Media Minutes. I think that's it.
Thanks.
Thank you. That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'm your host and producer, Paul Riesmandel, and I'll be back in 1 week with more news about grassroots and independent media, as well as our media environment. In the meantime, check out Media Geek online at MediaGeek.net, where you'll find the Media Geek blog with frequently updated news and views about our media. You can also download the program at radio.mediageek.net or subscribe to the podcast to have it automatically downloaded to your computer or MP3 player. That's all at mediageek.net. The closing music is Fire in the Sky by Adam Lowe. Media Geek is produced live at Community Radio WEFT in Champaign, Illinois. Some segments are pre-recorded at Media Geek Studios. And Media Geek is heard on 9 other community stations around North America, including KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, KQRP in Salida, California, KRBS in Oroville, California, WSLR in Sarasota, Florida, WTND in Macomb, Illinois, WRFA in Jamestown, New York, WYQZ in Warrenton-Bealeton, Virginia, CKDU in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and Free Radio Olympia in Olympia, Washington. Media Geek is free to air on your local community radio station, too. Just drop me a line at paul@mediageek.org. That email address is also good for any comments you want to send in about the program. Once again, that's paul@mediageek.org. Thanks for tuning in.